Now, have a listen to this.
You should be stronger than me. You've been here 7 years longer than me. Don't you know you're supposed to be the man? Now pale in comparison to who you think I am. You always wanna talk it through. I don't care. I always have to comfort you when I'm there. But that's what I need you to do. Stroke my hair. Cause I'm
immediately recognisable Amy Winehouse and Back to Black. The Amy Winehouse biopic was released to cinemas across the UK and Ireland last Friday. Music consultant for the movie, former bass player and musical director to Amy Winehouse, Dale Davis, joins us now from a London studio. Good afternoon, Dale.
Hello, Ray. How you doing?
Good to talk to you. When did you first meet Amy?
I first met Amy in 2003, August. I went for an audition and I didn't get it first time, but they called me in. And I started then.
Right.
And it lasted right up until the night before she passed.
What age was Amy then?
19.
Wow. Did you spot immediate star power in her?
Yes, I did. At the time, I was working with quite a few younger females around her age. And Amy just stood out. Firstly, she seemed to know herself as a young girl. And also just her singing and her vocal content was incredible. Mm. I knew she was going to be a star very quickly, but I didn't think she was going to be a star so quick.
And the lyrics and her performance and her stage presence were way beyond her 19-year-old years, weren't they?
Definitely, yeah.
Because Frank, we played Stronger there from Frank, and she just sounds like a seasoned jazz singer.
Yeah, Amy's very musical, probably one of the most gifted musicians I've ever worked with. And she had that ability to sing with an orchestra in one song and then sing on her own in another. And, you know, there could be quite a lot of things going wrong on stage, but as soon as Amy sang, everything settled down.
Mm. She said of you, my favourite person to go anywhere with.
That's
a nice compliment, isn't it?
It was. I was until she got married, and then after she separated from Blake, I was back to that position again. So.
Mm. And you hit it off. Why do you think you hit it off?
I've no idea. I think me and Amy drank Jack Daniels, so I think that was one way of bonding. But we were, I don't know, we just got on really well. And she always used to say that me and her were like the mum and dad in the band, because we'd tidy up after the band every night on the bus and stuff. So, you know, we bonded in silly ways, really, but we always got on.
Mm. Let's go back to the movie. So music consultant, so you must have been on set. I'm wondering, was it weird when you saw Marissa dressed as Amy for the first time?
It was. The band actually recorded all the songs that Marissa sang to in the film. So, and then myself and Adeo Mateo, Amy's vocalist, backing vocalist, we were on set to give the band direction, and I was there to give the authenticity to the equipment.
The authenticity to the equipment, right? Go on, explain yourself.
Well, to make sure that they had all the right guitars, drums, amps and keyboards, etc. So, yeah, there was a bit of sourcing of equipment.
Yeah. And difficult to ask for Marissa to sing Amy's songs.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, that's only part of the process. She has to be able to act,
yes,
talk like Amy and look like Amy and have the same mannerisms. So there's a lot involved. You know, I don't expect anyone to reach those sort of levels, but, you know, you're trying to just depict someone, aren't you, really, more than anything else.
So tell us about London then in the early noughties. And she was performing in clubs and pubs, and the reaction to her.
Yeah, the reaction was always amazing. When I first started working with her, within 2 weeks, we had to do a gig at Notting Hill Carnival, and she was a young white Jewish girl performing at a carnival, and within half a set, the crowd just turned up. And by the end of the show, she was so powerful that she didn't need a band there, and she was just incredible to work with for, you know, for many, many years.
Mm. And in the movie, I suppose we see a side to her that wasn't in the documentary. And this is going to sound odd, but she was quite ordinary in that, you know, she was a very kind person, very generous person. She had this lovely relationship with her nan and liked to do ordinary things.
Yes, that's very true. She, you know, she used to like to hang out with us and stuff like that. And she was always good fun to be around. And also, you know, she just had so much love for everyone. I think she loved so hard that I didn't think she got the love back that she probably thought she needed, you know, in the end. So.
And she had a sense of humour.
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, incredibly funny. And because she was so bright, she'd see things very quickly and make a joke out of it and have you in stitches. So.
Yeah, all the great comedians are very bright.
Yeah, you have to be. Yeah. And they've got a dark view of the world, haven't they?
Yes.
But they do it with such humour. So, I mean, I love that sort of thing myself.
Yeah. So when did you spot that things were going awry with Amy?
I'd say around the spring of 2007.
Right. She had met Blake in 2005 and they went on to get married in 2007.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think the problem was we'd been on the road since September of 2006 and we just hadn't stopped by the time we got to March. And, you know, I think it was physically very demanding on Amy. I remember talking to her 6 weeks before the end of the tour and I said to Amy, I said, look, try and, you know, we've only got another 6 weeks. And I could see the look on her face thinking, oh, another 6 weeks, you know. So it was a very intense period for her. And I think once you're on the road, it's very easy to get tired on the road because it's so demanding.
And Back to Black had just been a success beyond anybody's expectations.
Yep, she got everything right with that album.
Yeah.
And to show her how intelligent she was, I think with Frank, she witnessed how to record an album and she witnessed it once and then got everything right with the second album just by pure observation and knowing what she needed.
Mm.
I remember talking to her, congratulating on the success of Back to Black. She said, I knew what I was doing. And she didn't say it in an arrogant way. She just had that vision.
Yeah, and I don't know if you were with her on any occasions where she met with record company executives. But she knew her mind and she was confronted by men in suits and some of them not in suits, but mainly all men telling her she had to do this and do that and go that direction and this other direction. And she said, no, I'm doing it my way. I'm doing it Amy's way.
Yep, that's very true. The first day I ever met her in rehearsal, I was coming into the rehearsal studio and she was coming out with Nick Szymanski having a massive argument. It was a bright sunny day on a Sunday morning, but I thought, okay, this woman's got a lot of character, so I instantly took to her then.
Nick was her first manager. He worked with Simon Fuller.
That's right, part of 19.
Part of 19, and they did Spice Girls, so they were big hitters.
Yeah, but a wrong match, in my opinion. They're more manufactured, aren't they?
Yes, and did she, because she says it a couple of times in the movie, I wonder, did she ever say it within your earshot that she wasn't a Spice Girl?
No, but I knew that she wasn't that mainstream and she wouldn't necessarily like things like that. She had a very punk and rebellious attitude towards things like that.
Yeah. We play something from Back to Black. We play actually the title track, just a little bit of it. So you're saying 2007, you spotted things were going badly for Amy. She was just finished the tour, tired. And as a friend, you want to help, don't you?
Yeah, you do. And I think everyone wanted to help. But Amy liked to do things her own way. You know.
And was there any particular time when you tried to intervene or help and she refused help? Or what was the relationship?
We never really had that sort of relationship. Mm. We'd talk openly about things and, you know, I think the problem was there was just so much intense pressure on her and whether that would be with her private life or her career, you know, I think it's just relentless. So there was really no chance for her to take a break from anything.
Mm.
And it was at a time as well when, you know, you had difficulties with the press back in 2005 around that period as well.
Yeah, and I'm wondering, Dale, you're going down to local news agents of a morning or an afternoon. You've been a musician. And you see your friend there on the front page photographed by the paparazzi. Yeah. How did that make you feel?
I think it's a weird one, but it's just part of the machinery, isn't it? You know, you get famous through your art, and then everyone wants to know you. I suppose if you're a struggling artist, that's the sort of attention you want to a certain extent. So I think it's a very difficult thing to try and give an answer to, because one feeds the other.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it?
Also, she did work in journalism as well, so she knew how it worked.
Aha, uh-huh. Yeah.
Before she, you know, she had a short stint in journalism.
But, you know, the paparazzi, and they hunt in groups, don't they? Like wolves, and it's quite an ugly thing when you see it dramatised in the movie.
Yeah, that's true. I think the one other thing that Amy didn't do is she never spoke out. She never said a word to the press. So I think she was open to all sorts of abuse. You know, when you don't say anything, everyone's thinking, okay, well, she's, you know, could be this, that and the other. And she never actually came out and said anything. So I think that's why it was even worse than what it was. You know?
So now to the gigs. So you're there and she's going through hell with addiction. And I suppose you as a band don't know which Amy's going to turn up on an evening, do you?
I mean, there was a period of that really from about 2008 onwards. I think at that point, you know, she'd won the 5 Grammys and the performances start to get erratic. Blake was in prison. That had a big impact on her outlook on life. You know, in my opinion, she died of bulimia and eating disorder. But when Blake went down, she stopped sleeping.
Aha. Uh-huh. And we all know now, because it's we're talking about it all the time, how important sleep is. And you say you worked on the documentary, Amy, and the heartbreaking, tragic scene, the footage from the Belgrade concert in 2011, and you were on stage with her then. Can you talk us through that?
Yeah, for me, it was the most difficult night of my musical career. I don't want to make too much emphasis on it because I had so many great nights with Amy, but unfortunately, on this particular night, it was the first night where she wouldn't sing anything, and I don't remember much of the gig. I was in shock. Someone said to me afterwards that we played for an hour and 20 minutes, and I only remember the first half hour.
Right. So your body went into denial, I suppose.
Yeah. And it was, you know, obviously it was the end because it was the last show. But I don't want to focus on that because...
Well, you know, give us your high then of all the gigs you played with.
Well, there was many. I'd say for the first 4 years from 2003, from the time I worked with her to 2007, she was consistently brilliant. There was that many great shows. She used to take my ears off every night with her power and delivery. And also Amy had a very jazz approach to singing. Mm. She wanted to improvise every night. So she used to get bored of the lyrics or forget the lyrics after a year because she tried so many different avenues.
Yeah.
You work with a lot of people and they sing the same same way every night and they preserve themselves by that. But when you're pushing the boundaries, as Amy did, then, you know, you're going to eventually burn yourself out. And she was like that as a person. She just gave everything.
Well, let's hear her live then. Great performance. I believe she insisted on having your bass high up in the monitors.
Yes, and I had her vocals just as loud.
Right.
So it was just one of those things. I used to love feeding off Amy, and I think, you know, it was a nice compliment for her to say that. Definitely, it was a two-way thing as well.
Hmm. You were saying at the beginning there that you met her in 2003 and then right up to the night before she died was your last conversation. What do you remember about that conversation?
Well, I was out with her two nights beforehand. I was playing with her goddaughter Dion at the Roundhouse, and it was just around the corner from where Amy lived, and she turned up and went, oh, yeah, of course, Amy lives around the corner.
Hmm.
So we spent the evening hanging out, we spent a lot of time talking in the last 6 months, but we spent 2 hours, you know, just talking about stuff. She was very excited about her record label signing Dion. And then we left at 10 to 12 and I spoke to her at 11:30 on the Friday night before she passed. So she was on good form. She said she'd been watching YouTube videos of herself and saying that she could sing. And I went, of course, Amy, you're the best. You know, of course you can sing. But I'm glad she said that because she was a very humble person, never talked about herself in an arrogant way. So it's nice for her to just say to her, yep, I can sing. But we had a conversation, you know, we talked about my family, my son. She wanted to take him to the cinema. We talked about the band. She was looking forward to Nick Szymanski's wedding on the Sunday. I was going to see her the following day. So, you know, life doesn't make sense at that point.
No. And looking at YouTube at her own performances and saying to you, I can sing, but yet she had a confidence. So that sort of contradicts that a little bit, doesn't it?
Yeah, but I think it's a difference between having a vision and knowing how good you are.
Ah,
see what I mean?
Right.
So she could see the path of writing an album, but to actually talk about herself as being a great singer, no, she'd never do that. So I think they're two different things.
Yeah. Very sad, Dale, isn't it?
It is, yeah. The reason why I'm here is because she's not here. So, you know, it's something I live with day in, day out.
And do you think about what could have been, you know, because there was really only the two albums. I know there was a compilation posthumously, but there was just Frank and Back to Black. And you wonder, you know, she was just so much more tougher.
Yeah, I think so. She talked about acting, funnily enough, around that period where she started to get tired, when I talked about that in March 2007. And I think she would have been very good at that. Unfortunately, some people have short, impactful careers. I liken her to Kurt Cobain, Jimi Hendrix, you know, only around for 4 years. And they give you so much in a short space of time. And maybe that's their purpose. You know, it's very hard to know with all those things. You're just trying to base everything on hindsight, aren't you?
Mm. You're keeping her memory alive in the Amy Winehouse band. So you're on tour. Are you any plans to come to Ireland?
Yes, we've been in Ireland. We were there last November and we were there in February.
Aha. Uh-huh.
Yeah, so hopefully, I think we're due there in the summer and possibly in the winter.
Okay. Well, thanks so much for talking to us today, Dale. Dale okay. Davis, thank you very much. Thank you.
Thank you, Ray.
The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.